Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, September 23rd. We're very happy to have with us now one of the world's leading climate scientists, who is also one of the world's leading climate communicators across ideological lines. Catherine Hayhoe is chief scientist with the Nature Conservancy. She's an atmospheric scientist by training. Across various divides, she is a Canadian who now lives in Texas, and she is an evangelical Christian. And Catherine Hayhoe has a new book called Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World. It's interesting, too, in the context of the global climate talks taking place at the UN General Assembly this week and the UN's climate summit coming up in a few weeks. Dr. Hayhoe, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me just jump right in on one premise of your book, that to talk across political lines on the issue of climate change, it's better to focus on shared values and other common ground. Are there shared values when it comes to the politics of climate change and the audiences that disagree on it?
On the politics, there might not be, but on the fact that we are all humans, there definitely are. So we can connect over the fact that we're both parents and we want a better future for our kids. We might connect over the fact that we want a healthy economy where we can get jobs. We want a safe place to live. We might really enjoy something like tennis or jogging, or I've even started conversations over knitting or wine. The Rotary Club, the Lions Club, a shared faith, or sometimes even politics, because questions of energy independence and free market climate solutions, those are there, and they can be very powerful in motivating people when the issue is reframed to align with their values as opposed to counter to their values, which so often it is today.
For people in our New York listening area, for example, who may have a certain starting point on what they think about evangelical Christians or what they think, can you talk about your own evangelical Christianity and how it's consistent with being an evangelist for taking climate change seriously?
Yes. I'm originally from just over the border, so I am Canadian. And it wasn't until after I moved to the States, which I did for graduate school, that I even clued into the fact that Christians had a problem with climate change. Because if you read the actual Bible, and my personal definition of an evangelical is someone who takes the Bible seriously, I realize today the definition of an evangelical in the U.S. is typically a political party or a political position. But if you just read the Bible, it says at the very beginning that God gave humans, all humans, responsibility over every living thing on this earth. And then at the very end of the Bible, it says God will destroy those who destroy the earth. And then in between, you've got all kinds of things about caring for other people. The most marginalized and vulnerable and poor are the most affected by climate impacts. If you take your faith seriously, I truly believe that you'd be out at the front of the line demanding climate action instead of dragging your feet at the back.
And your book is called Saving Us. Is there a purposeful Christian implication there, like as in being saved?
Well, the title is almost slightly sacrilegious from a Christian perspective, but it is more reflecting on this. We're often asked and told that we need to save the planet, as if the planet is somehow other than us. But the reality is this planet will still be orbiting the sun long after we're gone. It's we who are at risk. It's our civilization. After the polar bears, we're next. And our future is in our hands. The science is clear. We still have the ability to save us, but only if we act.
Do you cringe when you hear environmentalists say, save the planet, because you want to scream, no, that's not the right message. It's we're saving people.
I actually do a little bit, because for a long time I viewed climate change as sort of, you know, an environmental issue that environmentalists care about and the rest of us wish them well. I mean, saving the planet is a worthy goal, don't get me wrong, but it's not one that I myself personally identified with. I cared much more about people who were suffering today, about the injustices that are occurring in the world right now. And so when I realized myself, just speaking for my own values, when I realized that climate change was a justice issue, that climate change disproportionately affects women and children in poor countries. It affects brown and black neighborhoods right here in Texas where I live. It disproportionately affects indigenous people who have already lost so much of their land and their rights. When I realized that climate change is so unfair, that's when I decided I have to do everything I can to help fix it. So when we make this a niche issue, when we make it only about the planet, not about anything else that's already at the top of people's priority list today, which could be their kids, their family, their job, the place where they live, we're losing out on connecting this issue to every single person on this planet. Because when you all get down to it, we live here. This is our home. This is the air we breathe and the water we drink and the food we eat and the materials we use to make our homes and everything we have. To care about climate change, you only have to be one thing. And that one thing is a human living on planet Earth. And if we can make that connection, then we all of a sudden realize, hey, I'm already the perfect person to care. And that's how we move the needle.
By the way, did you choose to live in Texas explicitly to put yourself in the position of having climate conversations across the political divide?
I did not. It was one of those serendipitous events where it was my husband who the university was recruiting, and I was the plus one. But when you look backwards, you realize that this was exactly the perfect place for me to be, because living in one of the most conservative cities in the United States, home of the oil and gas industry, but at the same time, a place that's incredibly vulnerable to climate impacts, it's the perfect place to have conversations. And trust me, I've had a lot of them that failed spectacularly. And so if you're listening and you're like, she does not understand, believe me, I have been there and I have had those conversations that ended, you know, so terribly that you even cringe today when you think about them. But I took those conversations and I learned from them and I started to turn them around. And in my book, I have so many examples of conversations that have started over something as simple as the fact that we both love going to the beach, or we're both farmers, or we both are concerned about the future of our city or our town or, you know, or our lakes. Those conversations that begin with something we agree on rather than beginning, as so many often do today, on something we disagree on, those conversations can go farther. And those conversations can really make a difference, because here's something really crazy, Brian. How has the world changed before? When we look at the way the world has been in the past with huge issues like slavery and civil rights and women's rights, the world has changed profoundly. And it wasn't when a president decided it had to. It was when ordinary people said, this is not right. This is not the way the world should be. The world can and must change. And they started to use their voices. That was the first step in knocking over the first domino in a long chain that eventually changed the world.
Yeah. And I see you say there will be a collective awakening, an O-S-H moment, as the New Yorker quotes you saying. I'm not sure if that's in the book, but I guess like many other environmental awakenings that you know, came when something really dramatic happened, like the cancer in Love Canal, New York, putting toxic waste on the map, that cancer cluster in the 1970s, or a river catching on fire in Cleveland back then, helping to launch the 1970s environmental movement, that sort of thing.
Yes. And yeah, I did not put that exact phrase in the book, the O blank moment. But I and other scientists are really afraid that we won't take action at a scale large enough to fix this problem until we hit that global oh crap moment. And with climate change, if we wait until then, it is too late. It's like not stopping smoking until you have lung cancer. We climate scientists are like the physicians of the planet. We have already done that scan. We have determined what's happening. We know why. We've been studying this for 200 years. And that's how we know it's not a natural cycle. It's not a volcano. It's not the sun. It really is us. And we've been so worried about the impacts that we first warned, and when I say we, I wasn't even alive back then. Scientists first warned a U.S. president of the risks of climate change in 1965. And that scientist, or that president, was Lyndon B. Johnson. So we scientists are really worried that people are not going to take this seriously enough. And a big part of that is because it has been framed as a planet issue, an environment issue, rather than a human issue that every human already has every reason they need to care about.
Could this summer's intense weather, the floods in the east and the drought and fires in the west, and things are going on in other countries too, be that oh crap moment?
Well, it's certainly heading in that direction. And last year, I did a study with colleagues at Yale University where we tracked 20 years of public opinion on climate change, and we compared that to where they had had heat waves and droughts and floods and wildfires. And we found that hot, dry extremes, like really hot droughts when it isn't raining, it's burning hot outside, they had changed people's opinions in the past. And anecdotally, we know that the number of people now who are alarmed or concerned about climate change in the U.S. are well over 50% of the population. And I think that's because we've been breathing in the choking air from the wildfires, and we've been experiencing the floods in our own basements, in our own towns and cities. But now is the time to act. We can't just sit there and wait and say, oh, that was bad luck, hope it doesn't come back again. Climate change is loading the weather dice against us. We already have 3 sixes and a 7 on our dice. And the time to act, to cut our carbon emissions, to invest in nature to soak up that carbon for us too, the time to act is now before we get an 8 on the dice.
Here's a caller, Soren at Rutgers University, who says he's a pastor's son. Soren, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. First time caller, I guess long time listener. I've been a pastor's kid for 20 years, and I recently stepped away from the faith because of my reckoning with like the impact climate change and how my church community has really exiled our world, mostly because the question on their mind that they struggle with, I think, is the idea that in Revelation, the idea that God is going to bring a new world and a new earth and essentially abandon this one. So my question is, how can we defend climate change when so many people believe that there's no use in trying to fix anything if it's just going to be thrown away?
That is a great question. And in fact, that is the second most popular religiously sounding objection that I hear. The first one being, if God is in control, how could humans affect something as big as this planet? So these are so popular and so endemic that I even made a global weirding episode about them. I have a YouTube series I do with PBS called Global Weirding. And what does the Bible say about climate change is the second most popular episode. To tackle that question, though, I don't go to the science. I go actually to what the Bible says, because that's where the argument is coming from, they think. But humans were humans 2,000 years ago. And in the city of Thessalonica, who Paul writes to in the book of Thessalonians, he had people who were quitting their jobs and sitting around saying, oh, well, the world's going to end anyway, so why do we care? And the Apostle Paul, being who he was, he didn't mince his words. He basically said, get off your rear, get a job, you know, feed your family, care for the widows and the orphans. And then later he goes on to say, you know, you don't know when the world's going to end. And we don't. Scientifically, we don't. And spiritually, we don't. You don't know when the world's going to end, but you have something to do right now. You are supposed to be, in the words of Jesus, recognized by your love for other people. How different would this world be if Christians were recognized by their love for people instead of for their judgmentalism, their political ideology, their infighting, and their outfighting? If we really take the Bible seriously, and I would encourage you to check out a great organization called Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. There are over 20,000 around the country who are picketing and petitioning and demanding climate action, clean energy standards at not just their schools, but their cities, their states, and in front of the White House as well. I think they're living out their faith. And if anybody believes otherwise, I would just say, read the Bible.
You remind me of a joke I heard from my Jewish tradition that a guy is stranded in a boat out in the sea and is afraid he's going to drown. And a cruise ship, but he's a very religious man, and a cruise ship comes along and says, would you like to come on our ship and be saved? He said, nope, God's going to save me. I have faith. And then somebody comes along in a low-flying helicopter and throws him a rope and says, you know, you can be saved. We'll take you up in our helicopter. He says, no, I'm a man of faith. God's going to save me. And the guy dies, and he goes to heaven, and he sees God, and he says, God, I had faith in you, but you let me drown. And God says, I sent you a helicopter and a cruise ship. What do you want?
That is so true. In fact, I've even seen a variant of that showing, you know, a what I would call a political evangelical getting to heaven. Political evangelicals being those of us whose statement of faith is written first by our politics and only a very distant second by what the Bible actually says. And if the two come into conflict, they will go with their politics over the Bible in conflict with the Bible. So it shows somebody like that getting to heaven and saying, you know, God, why didn't you save us from climate change? And God saying, you idiot, I sent you the scientists.
Exactly. I'd like to play you a clip, too, if we have time, of President Biden in his UN speech this week, where he talks about climate. Here's one.
When we meet the threat of challenging climate, the challenging climate we're all feeling, already ravaging every part of our world with extreme weather, or will we suffer the merciless march of ever-worsening droughts and floods, more intense fires and hurricanes, longer heat waves, and rising seas?
How would you grade that as a climate communicator?
I would grade that pretty high. He was eloquent. He used words that sort of evoke strong images. And it is absolutely true scientifically. Sea level is rising. Hurricanes are getting stronger. Wildfires burn in greater area. They're more intense. And our flood risk is increasing and heavy rainfall with it. So he is definitely talking about what's happening. But we have to connect it. We must connect it to our hearts. We must talk about our homes that are flooded. We must talk about our crops that are lost. We must talk about the air that our children are breathing that is filled with wildfire smoke that is incredibly dangerous for their lungs. We have to connect these issues to what's already in our heart, because going back to the title of the book, it's not about saving the planet. It is about saving us.
But here's Melanie in Brooklyn, who I think is being driven crazy by something that was not on that list that you just ticked off. Melanie, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Brian, I am a huge fan. I love you so much. I listen to you every day. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you. Good to have you.
Oh, my God. Okay. So I'm an atheist, but I was raised Catholic, and I find this conversation to be so hypocritical, and it's driving me crazy. According to your religion, if God put us all on this earth purposely, along with plants and animals, right? Why are you not speaking about plants and animals? Humans caused this climate problem, and animals have no voice in this. So I don't understand. If you are spreading all of this sort of humanity first thing, like, why do animals not come into this at all for you?
Dr. Hayhoe.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and thank you for being brave enough to express that, too, because I know it's always hard to call in when you have something to say that's difficult. And I want to just absolutely say I am not saying that I'm not talking about plants and animals, and I regret that I hadn't mentioned that up until this point, and I thank you for bringing that up. I'm the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, which is the largest conservation organization in the world. It is dedicated to helping to protect 30% of land area and 30% of ocean area by 2030, because we live with nature and we are part of nature. We are not separate from nature. So if you dig into the book a little bit more, you'll see the nuance is saving us is pretty much every living thing on this planet, because climate is changing faster, not only than any time in the history of human civilization. It's changing 10 to possibly as much as 50 times faster than between the last glacial maximum, the last ice age, and now. And so that means that trees cannot pick up and move fast enough to keep up with changing climate. Animals attempting to move poleward have their habitat fragmented, and they can't move across major highways or corridors or cities to get to where they need to be to adapt to the climate. We also know that coral reefs, which are the nurseries of the ocean, are being bleached by ocean heat wave events and by a lot of the carbon dioxide we're producing going into the ocean. So it really is going back, and in the book, actually, I have a great story about how I was talking with one of my colleagues and he said, I'm an atheist, but I care too. And I said, obviously you care. You're a human living on this earth. Every single one of us, no matter what faith we do or do not adhere to, we have every reason to care about this. And as a Christian, when it says in the book of Genesis and in the Judeo-Christian faith, it's the same text, humans having responsibility over every living thing, That is often actually interpreted the opposite way. You said it's often interpreted as only meaning plants and animals and not caring for our fellow human beings, not having compassion on our fellow human beings. But I truly believe that every living thing really means that. It means human and non-human living species.
So here's what I want to ask you in our last minute. As a climate communicator, do you prefer the term climate change or global warming or neither? And how about climate crisis versus climate emergency? There's a push to use the word emergency now.
I would say it's global weirding, because that's what we're experiencing in the places where we live. It is just getting weirder, and it is a crisis. It is not going to be fixed immediately like you could in an emergency room. It is a crisis that requires long-term action, recognizing that we in rich countries are responsible for the bulk of this issue. 3.5 billion poorest people produce 10% of the emissions contributing to this problem. So it absolutely is a justice issue, and it's a human issue, and it's an issue for every living thing on this planet. And so that's why my book was called Saving Us, All of Us.
Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, atmospheric scientist, is now the author of Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World. And as she mentioned, she hosts the YouTube PBS podcast, Global Weirding. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.